Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 5 Morning Talk Program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. I expect that most people, if you ask them, would point to the Cuban Missile Crisis as the most dangerous moment of the Cold War. Yet there was another, is another, less well-known chapter in that history. It came in 1983, when NATO was holding a major exercise in Europe. Apparently, at this point, the Soviets believed that the West was planning a surprise attack and came very close to launching a first strike. Our guest this morning, historian Richard Rhodes, says that we survived the Cold War by the skin of our teeth, and much of it was luck. He is well known for writing a series of books about the development of nuclear weapons and their significance about the Cold War. Last fall, the third volume in this nuclear history was published, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. It was published by Knopf in October, and certainly I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or the library. He's perhaps best known for his book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which won a Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. His second, Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, was shortlisted for a Pulitzer Prize in History. He's also authored the book Why They Kill, An Investigation of the Roots of Private Violence, a personal memoir, A Hole in the World, a biography, John James Audubon, and also four novels. And this morning he'll be talking with us about the most recent book in the nuclear history series, Arsenals of Folly. And questions are welcome, of course, as always, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us. At any point here, if questions are welcome, if you'd like to call in and ask a question, make a comment, we just ask people to try to keep their comments and questions brief so that we can keep our program moving. But of course, listeners are welcome into the show. And again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And we do also have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Mr. Rhodes, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
I think that it's interesting thinking about this particular event or series of events that took place in 1983 and how the United States, particularly how Ronald Reagan responded, because when he found out what was going on, he was very frightened. He was very concerned. And that was one of the things perhaps that spurred him on to putting more effort into arms negotiations with the Soviet Union.
Yes, indeed.
But I think it makes me think that, perhaps that people think that that we came to the brink, so to speak, only once. And that was indeed the Cuban Missile Crisis. It makes one wonder, in fact, how many times really during the Cold War we came closer than we certainly would have liked to the Cold War actually becoming hot.
You know, I've talked with people who are in a position to know, who tell me that there were any number of other incidents. And you encounter them in the records of various people. I found in Robert Gates, who's now Secretary of Defense, I found in his memoirs that he published after his stint as director of the CIA, an amazing story about Zeb Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and was the man whom was called before the president was called if there was any kind of nuclear threat. He was asleep in his bed in Washington one night in 1977 when a call came in from NORAD saying there were 200 incoming Soviet missiles on the radar. He had about 5 minutes before he knew he had to call the president, so he sent the officer back to check. And the call came in again a minute later saying, it's not 200, it's 2,000. So he said, check again once more. I still have a minute left. And just before he had to call the president to let the president have his 5 minutes to decide whether or not we should counterstrike the Soviet Union, the call came back. It was a mistake. Someone put a training tape in the computer. There are no such warheads. Brzezinski said that his wife was asleep beside him, and he had decided there was no point even in waking her up. They'd all be dead in 30 minutes. So this kind of thing has happened, and it's happened more than once, and I think it speaks to our sense then and our sense now of somehow being secure with our nuclear arsenals.
That's that kind of a story. It's chilling and frightening, and at the same time, in a strange way, it makes one want to laugh. Except that except that as soon as you have that sort of reaction, then you remind yourself, but wait a minute, this could have been the end of the Earth.
Yes, absolutely, because just around the time that President Reagan was reassessing his his belligerence toward the Soviet Union, which is really why the Soviets were so hyper alert about any possible attack in the mid-80s from the United States, because, as we recall, President Reagan was calling them the evil empire, and more importantly, he had increased the defense budget to almost $1 trillion over 5 years, essentially doubling what we were spending on defense and on nuclear weapons and delivery systems, which in itself was what raised the red flag. Yuri Andropov, who was head of the Soviet Union at that time, having just pulled the Soviet Union up to rough parity with the United States, couldn't figure out why we needed so many more weapons unless we were planning an attack. That's the background for that event in the fall of 83. But it was events like this NATO exercise confusion that led the president to realize he had to take a different tack on the whole business.
It seems that when you think back to this time, that the central emotion of the Cold War was fear, and that here in the United States, understandably enough, we were afraid of the Soviet Union. We were afraid that they would attack us. And at the same time, very clearly, the Soviet Union was afraid of the United States. And I suppose it's good to try, if it's possible, to capture that perspective and to look at what it is the United States did and how that must have looked to the Soviet Union.
Now, I was interested in researching this book exactly to go back with what we know now, and we know a great deal more about what weapons the Soviets had, how many they had, whether they would have done what they were supposed to do. To go back and look over the Cold War again and ask the question, was it what we thought it was? And first of all, of course we were afraid. Nuclear weapons are the most destructive human artifacts ever created, far more destructive than I think most of us even realize. And the fact that the Soviets were building such an arsenal threatened us greatly, even though there was never a time, any time in the Cold War, when in any meaningful sense of the word, we were behind. I mean, we counted the number of weapons on both sides, and so did they. And that's kind of ironic, because you only need 10 or 12. Maybe you only need one. I think that's pretty clear. So there was a fundamental fear. But beyond that, on both sides, to my great disappointment, and I think all of our disappointment, there was a lot of political manipulation of that fear. There was a great deal of threat inflation that was used throughout the Cold War on our side, and no doubt on the Soviet side, in fact, certainly on the Soviet side, to promote inter-service rivalry, to get people elected to national office, to build up our defense industry. These problems, which I think are inherent in this kind of situation, where you don't know for sure what the other side has, where you aren't sure you can ever have enough, even though, ironically, our leaders never felt that they would ever want to use these weapons. Let me tell you a story. I asked Robert McNamara, who was, of course, John Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, and who was involved deeply in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We knew at that point that the Soviets only had 4 ICBMs and that they were so primitive that they could only launch them one at a time across 24 hours. In other words, it would take 4 days to launch 4 missiles. I asked McNamara why we weren't more aggressive in going after the Soviets during the missile crisis, because we didn't know at that time how many warheads were actually in Cuba and on submarines, Soviet submarines in the Caribbean. So we presumably might have thought we had a clear field. But his answer was immediate. He'd obviously thought about it. He said, neither the president nor I would ever have countenanced a political decision that would have led to the explosion of one nuclear weapon over one American city. So how many do you need, if those are the terms? So there was definitely a disconnect between our feelings of fear as a citizenry, and the same on the Soviet side, and what our leaders knew and understood about the weapons they were piling up on both sides.
These weapons that we're talking about, these very large bombs, or perhaps that would be delivered by ballistic missiles, or perhaps multiple warhead missiles, these are things that are called, they're referred to as strategic weapons, as opposed to things that you would use potentially on the battlefield. I know that military people would say actually they're impractical to the point of being useless on the battlefield.
Sure.
But the strategic nuclear weapons, these kinds of things we're talking about, I think the strategists would argue that the main purpose of these things is deterrence, is so that your opponent knows that if he would launch a first strike against you, that your opportunity to retaliate would be so massive that it would guarantee his destruction as well as yours.
Exactly.
And I think that there are some people who would say the fact that both sides understood that meant that the weapons would never be used. And some people would say that there was, in a way, you could view these as successful in the sense that since Hiroshima and Nagasaki, all that time, all through the Cold War, no nuclear weapon was used.
True. And deterrence was a theory that was developed really behind the fact of the arms race, if I may put it that way. That is to say, people who were working on weapons in the 50s tell me that their job was to crank them out as fast as they could. The theory followed from the fact of producing the weapons. What does that mean? It means that deterrence as a theory was kind of a cover for a general sense that, as President Eisenhower said, the only thing we can think to do is to just keep piling them up since we don't really know how to protect ourselves. The Soviets evidently didn't really have a deterrence theory. Their response was based more on their experience at the beginning of the Second World War, when they were overwhelmingly attacked by Nazi Germany in a surprise attack and had to marshal everything they could pull together to try to defend themselves. So their approach fundamentally was going to be, if we attacked them, they were going to hit us with everything they had. The problem with deterrence, and particularly as you build up more and more weapons in your stockpile, is that if it fails, and it's after all built on assumptions about the logic of people's response, the rationality of people's response, that might not follow if someone attacked and destroyed Moscow and killed 6 million people, or vice versa, New York. Maybe people wouldn't be so rational at that point. The problem with deterrence is that if it fails, you destroy the very thing that you have been trying to protect. It was never a very good solution, and it was indeed rather after the fact. We didn't really quite know what to do. And one of the things that I discovered that was fascinating to me was the extent to which all of our institutions and organizations involved in nuclear issues, and particularly in nuclear targeting, basically underestimated the destructiveness of the weapons. For example, we targeted the Soviet Union with weapons based entirely on their blast effects, even though nuclear weapons are primarily weapons of mass fire. So we would target a bridge or a railroad junction or a telephone center or an airfield, and we would only think about what the blast effects would be, when in fact, if you put these things down anywhere, they produce huge mass fires that consume whatever is around for miles and miles. So I guess my final conclusion about deterrence is that it was part of the general muddle. Mm. There was another strain of thought that emerged in the 1980s, starting from UN and Swedish sources, who were thinking about how you could get past this everybody holding a gun to everyone else's head. They started talking about something that they called common security, the idea that the only way you could really be safe is if you took your enemy's security needs into consideration as well as your own. If you didn't sit down at the negotiating table simply to try to see what you could get from the other guy and give as little as possible, but rather sat down and really seriously talked about what you needed and asked them what they needed in order to back off from these confrontations. That's what Mikhail Gorbachev brought to the table in his negotiations with President Reagan at Reykjavik and prior to that in Geneva. And it's what turned the tide, because President Reagan was interested after these events in the early 80s that scared everybody, including him, in trying to eliminate nuclear weapons, curiously enough.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest. We've been talking for a while. I want to make sure if anybody who's tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, they know who they're listening to. Our guest in this hour is Richard Rhodes. He's the author or editor of 22 books, among them three now, that have to deal with the history of nuclear weapons and their place in the history of the 20th century. His first book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, won a Pulitzer Prize, also the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle. His second, Dark Sun, was a history of the making of the hydrogen bomb. His third, published last fall, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race, looks at the international politics of nuclear weapons throughout the Cold War. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just to talk a little bit more about how people thought about nuclear war, it seems as if military planners thought about these weapons as just another bomb, admittedly a very big bomb, but just another bomb. And now, again, perhaps it's the benefit of hindsight, it seems very difficult to understand how one could have thought that a large-scale nuclear war with the Soviet Union and the United States launching multiple missiles that would do this kind of devastation on both sides would be the kind of thing that you could think about winning or surviving.
Right. Well, and here was their problem, the military's problem. They were given a task that was impossible. Their task was to somehow figure out a way using nuclear weapons to defend the United States against a nuclear weapons attack. And you simply can't do that. The calculations that were run, the simulations that were run, all indicated that even if we hit the Soviet Union early on, let's say in the mid to late 60s, with everything we had in our arsenal, that there would still be perhaps 5% of what they had that would get through. And again, when you hear the Secretary of Defense or a president say that one nuclear weapon on one city was unthinkable from the point of view of international negotiations and politics, then you understand that 5%, which is maybe 75 weapons, simply isn't something that would be acceptable. Nevertheless, that's what the military's task was, to figure out a way to prevent these things from happening. And the only structure that the military had as an organization in which to put these weapons, a context for them, was conventional weapons. So by minimizing the effects of the weapons themselves, by focusing on blast effects for their targeting plans rather than on the full-scale effects of fire and fallout and so forth, it was possible just barely to shoehorn these huge weapons of mass destruction into this other context. I don't mean this to be a criticism of the military. If you give someone an impossible task, they understandably find some way to adjust it to make it seem possible. But everyone understood at the political level, and here I think there is some blame to be assigned, at the top level of leadership in this country and in the Soviet Union, every leader after Stalin and every president from Truman forward said at one time or another, there's no context in which I would ever consider using these weapons. Mm-hmm. Now, that you would think would be an argument for figuring out a way to get rid of them, since they're so dangerous to the security of one's country. But instead, what happened is they were used as kind of political counters in the international game of politics and negotiation and trying to threaten the other side. Again, both sides were using them this way. really adding to the risk because of the possibility of misunderstanding, as the example of the NATO exercise in the fall of 83, when there was real misunderstanding. So the result really was we were very lucky throughout the Cold War. And the time when the time came when Reagan and Gorbachev began to realize that there were other alternatives, there was properly a great sigh of relief around the world, although it didn't come to as much as each man hoped it would.
We have a caller. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation? Good. Someone who is listening this morning in Champaign, and that would be line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes. Yes.
Long ago in a college history class, the professor told the story that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, that a base out of Russia actually did launch a nuclear missile toward the United States, but they were able to shoot it down because it was unauthorized.
No, I've never heard that, and I can't imagine that it would have been true. For this reason, the Strategic Air Command had everything in our arsenal in the air at that time. I mean, the Minuteman missiles had just come online that week, and they were prepared to launch. But we also were flying all of our B-52s round the clock all week. And at the height of the crisis, we actually turned all of our planes and flew them past their normal turnaround points toward the Soviet Union. During that period, we were watching the Soviets very closely. They did not even go to full alert. So I think it's highly unlikely, first of all, that they would even accidentally have launched a missile. And second, I can't think of any obvious way in those days, much less now, that they could have shot it down. We don't even today have an effective ballistic missile defense, despite what we hear out of Washington. So I think that's perhaps an apocryphal story.
Oh, well, supposedly the United States allowed this sort of like this fail-safe controls to leak over to the Russians so that they had more control over any sort of accidental launch?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think, you know, we didn't have any real links with them at that time. The hotline, for example, that we now are familiar with came out afterward as a result of the scare of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think rather what the Soviets did, realizing that Curtis LeMay and General Tommy Power were prepared to bomb them if they so much as blinked, was to keep everything unscrambled and sitting on the ground to make sure that they didn't give him any reason to go ahead and do the attack that he certainly was eager to do.
Well, General LeMay wanted to provoke a war, didn't he? We were kind of overflying Soviet territory.
We had been overflying the Soviet territory all the way up to 1960. In order to try to see what was going on, we didn't have any satellites in those days. When the first satellite system went up in 1960, someone who was involved in it told me it was like you pulled back a curtain on a stage. You could suddenly see the whole country in a way they hadn't been able to before. That's when we discovered that they only had four ICBMs and that they weren't the sort of ICBMs that could be promptly launched. And that really, in a way, is what led to the missile crisis, because President Kennedy made sure that the Soviets knew we knew how limited their arsenal was as a way of saying, stop threatening us over Berlin, as Khrushchev was in those days. Khrushchev's response seems to have been to think, if I could move some missiles to Cuba, as the Americans have missiles in Turkey right on our borders, maybe we would have a bit of a deterrent until such a time as we can get more long-range missiles built and deployed. So there were many overflights during the 50s, and we lost a number of people, planes that crashed for various reasons in the Soviet Union.
These are the U-2 flights?
Yeah, the U-2s came later. Originally, it was small, fast bombers that we were flying kind of on our own, and then with the help of the British, they would enter Soviet airspace and go as far as they could and then turn around and run back.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Let's continue. We have a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are. Line number two. Hello.
Much of it can. So sorry, am I here?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. You're mainly talking about it as the bipolar, and that is definitely the way the Cold War is viewed, but a lot of the Cold War was played out in the Third World, and I wonder what you say about Daniel Ellsberg's thesis that, you know, every American president has used a nuclear bomb in the sense of a pointed gun threatening someone, that we have the surreal example of Nixon appointing, flying a lone B-50 or B-28, I guess it was, over Hanoi, with the idea that this was the threat. There's the idea that Eisenhower actually supposedly in some way threatened Guatemala with a nuclear bomb.
Yes.
So the Third World, the multidimensionality, I have another question about Reykjavik and sort of Reagan's...
Well, the Third World part. Because neither the Soviet Union nor the United States dared to use nuclear weapons on each other, the Cold War began to be fought out around the periphery of the two countries, in client states rather than in the states themselves. What's interesting about that is that, and yes, it's true, there were lots of threats that were made by both sides, brandishing of nuclear weapons in various crises deliberately to try to influence the outcome of those crises. What's interesting, I found a study, someone looked very closely at those threats. We actually fared worse in terms of the outcome when we threatened to use nuclear weapons than when we didn't. All you have to do is think about the wars we fought across the Cold War. For example, Korea, and obviously Vietnam, and on the Soviet side, their adventure in Afghanistan, to realize that we didn't win any wars during this period. If nuclear weapons are perceived to be weapons that give you more political and international clout, the fact is they had the opposite effect. They made it less possible for us to resolve some of these conflicts that we became involved with. The reason, of course, being that behind the client states was always the superpower, and at some point we had to back off, and they had to back off, rather than risk a nuclear confrontation. So despite flying planes over Hanoi and so forth, despite our threats, the outcome really wasn't to our advantage in any of these instances. And in fact, in Vietnam, we lost. If you think about it, it's pretty ironic. After all, we could have, as people were saying in those days, paved North Korea. We only would have had to kill a few hundred million people with nuclear weapons, but of course we couldn't use nuclear weapons because of the Soviet backing of the North Korean war.
When, if I might ask on this line, did the Soviets use it? When did they announce their no first use policy, which the U.S. never really did?
Yeah. I think they came up with no first use pretty early, and it was clearly only a propaganda statement, because if we look at the example of the NATO exercise in the fall of 83, it's pretty clear that Yuri Andropov was seriously considering first use to get a jump on what he thought was our plan for first use, which I think is what it always comes down to when you finally are facing what you think is such a confrontation. There were various nuclear threats made, particularly by Khrushchev, in various conflicts in the 1950s. And in a sense, I suppose the Cuban Missile Crisis could be considered one of those too, in the sense that he was mounting missiles right next to our southern border.
Of course, we had him in Turkey, so...
Yeah, exactly.
That was,
of course, his reason for thinking we would put up with missiles in Cuba, because, after all, he'd been putting up with missiles in Turkey.
Mm-hmm. This idea that Reagan was an authentic abolitionist. I saw Mr. Schell compliment you very much recently on Charlie Rhodes and Rose, and he said that no Republican has claimed that part of the Reagan legacy, and he was encouraging them to do it. But the linchpin is the same linchpin we have now, and that's, it seems to be, weapons in space and the missile shield. Now, if you're getting rid of nuclear weapons in an authentic way, what do you need a missile shield for?
Sure.
And so the point being that I don't think that he either was authentically an abolitionist, or whether it was the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower...
No, really. In fact, if you will pick up a copy of Arsenals of Folly, my book, you will find a very detailed reconstruction based on the original transcripts of the debates that he and Gorbachev had at Reykjavik. And you'll see that he really was an abolitionist. But unlike Gorbachev, who came there with the idea that the way to eliminate nuclear weapons was to make both sides feel secure in whatever negotiated way that needed to be, Reagan thought that there was a technological solution to eliminating nuclear weapons, and that was to have some protection in case, after all the weapons had been eliminated, somebody decided to cheat. And, of course, his technological solution was his dream of an umbrella over the United States, of a system in space that would shoot down enemy warheads as they came over the horizon. So that, of course, was not a real solution.
Of cooperating and letting them also use the shield, and that has even been...
And he did make that offer to Gorbachev, and Gorbachev famously said, "You won't even share milking machines with us, Mr. President. It would take a second American Revolution to get you to share a system like the one you're talking about," which was true. Reagan, however, really deeply believed that the idea of a strategic defense initiative was his original contribution to the whole debate. He deeply also believed that this country was invulnerable to any other kind of attack except nuclear war. And he loved this country, and he was really determined to find a way to protect it by eliminating nuclear weapons. But he was not prepared, as Gorbachev insisted he must do at Reykjavik, to delay the deployment of any system that we were developing for 10 years while they initiated the process of eliminating nuclear weapons, and of course included all the other nuclear weapon states, not just these two. Reagan was prepared to think about it, and there was a moment at Reykjavik which was really dramatic and extraordinary when he went round the room of his advisors saying, "Am I wrong to reject this deal because of this 10-year restriction to the laboratory of SDI?" And George Shultz, the Secretary of State, said, "No, Mr. President, we can settle that at Geneva negotiating down the road. It's a great deal this guy's offering. Let's take it." And all the others said that, too, except for one, Richard Perle. Richard Perle said, "Mr. President, if you accept this deal, it will destroy SDI." And the president listened to Mr. Perle and went back and said, "No deal." And so they left Reykjavik without the beginning of what truly would have been a historic transformation of eliminating nuclear weapons.
Pardon me, Mr. Rhodes, for interrupting you. I was just going to jump in and remind people who are listening they're moving into about our last 15 minutes here. And I have somebody else I want to get to, so I want to thank the caller for his comments. Just very quickly, though, I'm interested in coming back to this point about the first strike.
Yes.
I suppose that some military planners would say, well, the only way that one could even think about surviving nuclear war would be if you strike first. Now, both the United States and the Soviet Union publicly said, no, we would never do such a thing. But the fact of the matter is that at various points, the military planners of both sides did indeed develop first strike plans.
Well, in fact, it would have been the only way they thought that you could actually hope to come close to, quote, winning, unquote, a nuclear war. And the idea was basically one of preemption. If we saw signals coming from the other side that they were preparing to launch or had launched, then the idea was to launch ahead of them. So first of all, so that their missiles would hit our empty silos, but even better would be if you could catch them before they actually launched at all. That was part of the planning. Of course, there was no other way. And that's where we were left again with the fact that deterrence really was not a successful policy, except by sheer luck.
Well, we have another caller here, and someone who clearly must be listening to us on the internet because they're in Berkeley, California. Line number four. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just read your Making of the Hydrogen Bomb book. Very interesting.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
I have run across some news that by 2015, the Russian early warning network will be degraded to the point where they won't have sufficient early warning capacity to know whether they're being attacked or not, with time to decide about what to do about it.
Yeah.
And they'll have to revert to a strategy or policy of launch on warning.
I think they're there and have been there for a long time, actually, as are we. Unfortunately, we're still at launch on warning.
Okay. Solutions to this might consist of reducing the number of warheads to somewhat below 1,000 and putting together a decent missile defense on both sides so that the strategic arsenals can be reduced in their capacity to actually deliver over long ranges, and make nuclear weapons essentially be only useful locally, that is, as a deterrence against a physical invasion.
Or
think of them as IEDs.
You left out a solution that is extraordinarily resurgent in the last 2 years, and particularly since the beginning of this year, which is the idea that it's time to take a good look at how we might eliminate nuclear weapons entirely from all the arsenals of the world.
Right.
This is a movement that has been started in various places, but most notably, if you're in Berkeley, down at Stanford at the Hoover Institution, of all strange places, in the work of George Shultz and the group around him, they are proposing that it's time now to consider getting rid of all nuclear weapons. I would say, by the way, that although the Soviet early warning system has been degrading, the fact that they are recovering economically and certainly flexing their muscles again would imply that they're likely to restore their system by the time limit of 2015.
Yeah.
The better solution would really be for us all to consider whether we need these damn things or not.
Yeah, the problem is that they get easier to build as time goes on.
And that's one of the reasons why it's a good idea to get rid of them before they get easier to build. I think 9/11 was a major marker for people around the world in thinking about nuclear weapons, because it was clear that if those terrorists had had a nuclear weapon in their hands, it would have been a much more destructive and horrible event than it was. That, I think, is what led people like George Shultz, who's, after all, a fairly conservative Republican Secretary of State, to reconsider all these questions in the light of the present circumstances. It's a pretty exciting time in terms of the number of groups and movements and governments around the world, including most recently the Prime Minister of England, Gordon Brown, who has announced that he will lead the way toward the whole question of how we might go about eliminating these things. It's, of course, a big challenge, a huge challenge. There are something like 2 million kilograms of plutonium in the world and another 2 million kilograms of highly enriched uranium. It's going to be hard to track all that down and get it under lock and key.
Yeah.
But I think if people want to, they can.
Yeah, I think it's sort of a fool's errand to try to reduce the number to zero. You can get close. I mean, I think the impulse
that's what everyone has said before.
Zero is
that's what everyone has said before. But I think the Shultz group, which is a group of people who certainly have plenty of experience in dealing with nuclear issues, if they think it's possible, then I'm prepared to think it's possible. We'll see what the rest of the world thinks. They're having a conference next week, which I'm attending in Oslo, to let the rest of the world look at what they've proposed and get some good feedback about other people's perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, as long as they're not planning on going absolutely to zero, as long as the plan considers that people will cheat, they will retain arsenals of, tens or maybe even a larger number than that in bombs, and claim that they have none.
Of course, that this is obviously one of the things they're thinking about and talking about.
Yeah.
You obviously have to have a much more transparent world than we have even now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too bad that the, was it the Lilienthal?
Yes, the Acheson-Lilienthal plan, yeah.
Yeah. It's too bad that wasn't taken up and implemented from the beginning.
Amen.
That is really, oh, well.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. Okay, well, good to talk to you.
Well, thanks for the call. We have indeed about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Richard Rhodes. He's the author of a number of books, including three that look at the history of the development of nuclear weapons, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, a book that won a number of prizes, including a Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction. Dark Sun, The Making of the Hydrogen Bomb, and the most recent that was published last fall, Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race. And questions are welcome. We have some others, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back here to someone local in Urbana, line one.
Oh, yes.
Yes, hello.
Mr. Rhodes, thank you very much. Excellent. When I read your book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, I was amazed at how well and detailed it was. Excuse me, but I agree with your argument, and all this is sort of an idealism to think that we can get rid of all these things. But even one, if one were to go off, you know, yeah, a hydrogen bomb, you know, I mean, the people, the amount of people that would die is astonishing. And also on 9/11, I remember reading something recently, maybe the last year or so, somebody said that one of the aircraft flew right over Indian Point, the nuclear reactor.
Yeah.
And they said, well, they had thought, oh, hell, we'll just crash into that thing. Probably would have, you know, ruined about a few thousand square miles of if it broke.
Actually, the tests that have been done on reactor containment would indicate that it wouldn't have done anything except,
oh, really,
mash up the plane.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe the stored fuel that's not, you know, in a dome. But yeah. But I'm glad you're going to Oslo, because I know I follow this sort of in a peripheral way. But it's interesting to think that people. I'm glad that people are now thinking.
Yes.
About getting rid of these things. I mean, before, and you're instrumental in this, you and Jonathan Schell are really instrumental in getting this stuff out there and talking about it, and I really want to thank you for that. I think you're an important person.
Thank you very much.
And, I mean, really, I mean, a lot of people don't, I mean, they know your work, oh, maybe through your books, but, I mean, you're an advocate of this stuff. And
indeed.
I'm really happy. I've read your stuff, and I've always wanted to talk to you. And I don't know what else to say other than.
Well, thank you very much. I think that those 19 terrorists probably had a lot to do with the resurgence of interest in eliminating nuclear weapons.
I think, in a sense, they did the opposite of what they thought they'd do. I mean,
yes.
It's sort of like one of those things, the black swan analogy. You don't really know the outcome of your actions per se.
Right.
And they really have brought this to the forefront because. What they did to the World Trade Center, and I mean the psychological part was, my God. I mean the first thing everybody thought of. I mean, I read something, you know, right after that happened, everybody thought, oh, there's a nuclear weapon somewhere offshore, and everybody got all
exactly paid. Yes.
And I don't know if that's true or not. It might have been, you know, hyperbole, but it's just it's amazing. I'm so happy to talk to you. I mean, being a bullion and effusive, but you, what you've written is so important. And so instrumental in the psychology.
Well, thank you very much.
Because, you know, after World War II, I mean, there was a recent book published by, there's a writer who was in Nagasaki, and it's his son found his notes.
Right.
I don't know if you read that or not. But I did read the book, and, I mean, you realize this guy walked around in this stuff. It was edited. And really, thank you, and keep up the good work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Everybody in this country should appreciate your work.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the call.
David, may I just add something?
Yes, sir.
We were talking about first strikes and so forth.
Yes.
One of the things that Gorbachev pointed out after he did his homework on the whole subject of nuclear exchanges was that he said at one point to his people in the Politburo, you know, it really wouldn't matter if we delivered our weapons or just blew them off right where they are here at home, because the effect, which that he was referring to, the whole panoply of effects that are subsumed under the term nuclear winter, which has recently been re-examined using the much more sophisticated climate models that have been developed with better computers and because of concerns with global warming. It turns out that the nuclear winter scenario is even more terrible than was estimated back in the mid-80s when it first came up, when Carl Sagan and others were doing the work. Gorbachev was aware of that work, and when he said, we don't have to deliver the weapons, we could just blow them up at home, he was talking about the fact that there is no safety from nuclear weapons except their elimination. He was very aware of that.
Do you think that Mr. Gorbachev has gotten the credit that he deserves for his role in ending the Cold War?
No, and one of the reasons I wrote Arsenals of Folly was because doing the research for that book, I realized that there was a movement to, in this country, among conservatives, to put Reagan at the top of the pile as far as the hero of the end of the Cold War. And I don't mean to take away from his contribution. It was very important that someone with his particular credentials took the position he did, that we should eliminate nuclear weapons. But Gorbachev is the one who drove that dialogue. Gorbachev is the one who came up with a solution that would have worked and will work when it's finally put into play, which, again, is to say everyone's security interests have to be considered and resolved. That is to say, Israel's security interests and Pakistan's and India's and China's and Russia's and ours and so forth, before we're going to be able to put these weapons away. That was Gorbachev's insight. That was, unfortunately, something Reagan was not focused on, and it's why the Reykjavik summit ended without an agreement to begin this long process. So I think Gorbachev deserves to be seen as one of the truly great historic figures of the 20th century for what he began. It's interesting that the George Shultz group that is now developing ideas for how to eliminate nuclear weapons is calling itself the Reykjavik Reunion Group, because Shultz was at Reykjavik. The first meeting of this group was 2 years ago on the 20th anniversary of the Reykjavik summit, and the second meeting this October on the 21st. So they're trying to follow through on the initiative that began with those two leaders at Reykjavik back in 1986. And let me just add, I'm at work now on a play about the Reykjavik summit. It just asked to be dramatized on stage. It was such a remarkable event. And I have support from the MacArthur Foundation to get the play written and, I hope, produced.
We have some other callers here. I'll try to get at least one more in the time that's left. And this is someone in Urbana, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Given the unanimity of the sane people in this world about the need for nuclear disarmament, how do you explain the present administration's determination to develop new weapons? And in particular, I wonder what would be the effect of using the type of weapon they refer to as a bunker buster.
A bunker buster, yes. You know, they really are a kind of throwback to an old-time conservatism that I guess really I think has seen its day, at least in international affairs. The idea that you go it alone, that you don't trust treaties, that you use your muscle, none of which, unfortunately, has worked out very well for them, or perhaps fortunately. As far as the idea of a bunker buster, you know, it's been clear from the literature since the first Gulf War that we were really deeply frustrated that we couldn't kill Saddam Hussein down in his bunkers 30, 60, 100 feet below ground. Ever since then, I've noticed an undercurrent of discussion about we need a weapon that can penetrate deep bunkers underground. So that's what the bunker buster idea, which, by the way, has not gone anywhere. I think we've reconfigured some warheads, but they can't penetrate very deeply. Someone did a study of what would happen if one of these weapons, which had yields up to a megaton, had been used to penetrate the earth and concrete in any of a number of locations in Iraq that might have been places where Saddam was located. What they found was that the fallout, as it blew eastward, would probably kill several million people. In other words, this was not going to be a local, clean, surgical sort of strike at all. This was going to be a huge mess with a tragedy and a disaster for the world. So, thankfully, Congress has resisted the blandishments of the Bush administration about that and the so-called reliable replacement warhead, which was going to be a whole new line of warheads to upgrade and maintain our existing arsenal. We're moving in the direction of finding less and less use for nuclear weapons. In fact, there never has been a use for nuclear weapons except mass destruction, and that's really not part of our national policy, I hope.
So then a strike on Iran would probably affect India?
Yeah. Yes.
Perhaps even as far as Thailand?
And a strike on Iraq would certainly have affected Iran, which is the calculation that I was referring to.
Yes.
Would have killed hundreds of millions of Iranians.
Well, thanks for your comment.
All right, thank you. One more. Morris, line four. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. I kind of disagree with you in a way. It would be nice in the real world, the real world to get rid of all these things. But you know what? We've got people running around in other parts of the world that want to take us out.
Sure.
No matter what.
Sure.
Okay. So if we get rid of all our bombs, Russia gets rid of all our bombs, and these guys all of a sudden figure out a way to do something, because they are, you know, then they can hold everybody hostage, and they will. I mean, so what
I've never quite been able to
like that.
I've never quite been able to visualize this scenario. Holding hostage, what does that mean? I mean, they could say, what would we do, what would we have to do if they had a nuclear weapon in their pocket? But more to the point, look, if we eliminated all nuclear weapons, one of the problems for the rest of the world would be that the United States would be even more distinctly a superpower with its vast conventional military than any other country in the world. We would have to probably reduce our military strength in order even to convince other countries to think about going non-nuclear. But the idea of going non-nuclear involves keeping track of, taking care of, securing all those nuclear materials around the world, which sounds like a tall order, but in fact those materials are under some kind of lock and key even today. Nobody wants 5 kilograms of plutonium wandering around the world and falling in the hands of people like Osama bin Laden, who one understands has been trying to put together a nuclear arsenal for a long time. So those are problems that have to be resolved. People like George Shultz are not pie-in-the-sky people. He was the Secretary of State for 8 years. He's dealt with real and practical problems, including the collapse of the Soviet Union. So if he's serious about this, and if people like Sam Nunn and even Henry Kissinger, who are part of this group, are serious about it, I think we should withhold our criticism and take a look at what they have to say. If they're wrong, then it won't work. If they're not, then it'll be a great day for the world.
We will have to leave it there because we have come to the end of the time. Our guest, Richard Rhodes, is the author of a number of books, including these that we've mentioned that have to do with the history of the development of nuclear weapons, The Making of the Atomic Bomb, which was the first and won him a Pulitzer Prize. The most recent is Arsenals of Folly, The Making of the Nuclear Arms Race, published by Knopf. Mr. Rhodes, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.